Good morning. Before I forget, Steph is going to be right outside of these doors to get you pre-registered or registered for Vacation Bible School. That way, when you come in tonight, you won't have to worry about doing that part. So Steph will be right outside of that table, or right outside that door at the table there. It's going to be a pretty short one. A lot of us, of course, know America's Got Talent. I think that's getting ready to kick off again. Britain has its own version, Britain's Got Talent. And of course, I'll let you guess where that is aired at. It is the English cousin of our American version, but it shares a lot of things in common with our show. It has a stage that has all kinds of different acts where everybody across the British Isles comes to compete in a giant talent show. It also has three judges to decide which acts are going to proceed on to the next level. And of course, it has Simon Cowell, who is, I guess, most universally the most disliked judge, who makes it his life's goal to belittle and put down any act that doesn't meet his high standards. Now, he's my favorite judge. And in fact, I made the complaint this year. I hadn't watched American Idol in several years, and I turned it on and I said, nobody is making fun of anybody. This isn't fun at all. And so I miss Simon Cowell. I guess he's still on America's Got Talent. But several years ago, a 47-year-old Scottish woman competed on Britain's Got Talent. You could see Cowell visibly smirk as this frumpy, unattractive singer walked on stage. Her hair was graying and thin, and it wasn't styled. She was overweight. It turns out that she was the last of nine children. She had been deemed slow by her teachers. She had spent the bulk of her adult life taking care of her elderly and sick parents. And as she explained that her dream was to be a professional singer, the studio audience almost at the same time began groaning and giggling at her naive aspirations. Everybody appeared ready to just let her go on and embarrass herself and leave the stage so someone with real talent might emerge from the wings. But what they got to see that day was Susan Boyle giving her jaw-dropping, awe-inspiring version of I Dreamed a Dream. Well, God delights in the triumph of the weak. Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, beginning in verse 27, that God chose what is foolish in this world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, that so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. God has always favored the weak, the lowly, the despised, the things that are not. James asked the question in James 2 verse 5, saying that has God not chosen those who are poor in the world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom, which he has promised to those who love him? Well, the psalmist would write in Psalms 113, beginning verse 7, that he raised the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes of his people. In Isaiah, God says that if you pour yourself out for the hungry and you satisfy the desire of the afflicted, then shall your light rise in the darkness and your gloom be as noonday. And as Solomon puts it in Proverbs 22:9, whoever has a bountiful eye will be blessed, for he shares his bread with the poor. Repeatedly throughout the Old Testament, God instructs his people to be careful to take care of the widows and the orphans, to allow the poor to glean from the edges of their field, and to pray and fast so that they could use the money that they might have spent on food to give to the poor. And in the New Testament, that theme is repeated. Jesus spent most of his time with the lower classes, with the lepers, with the tax collectors, with the prostitutes, so much so that the Pharisees grumbled about it. And Luke tells us in Luke 15:2 that the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." In Matthew, the 25th chapter there, Jesus talks about the day of judgment. And he tells us that on that great day, that God will separate the sheep from the goats. But what's interesting is the criteria that God uses to judge those he accepts and those he doesn't. Beginning there in verse 34 of Matthew 25, Jesus says, "Then the king will say to those on his right, 'Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me.'" And then it says, "Then the righteous will answer him, saying, 'Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you?' And the king will answer them, 'Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me.'" And then to the goat who goes into the fires of hell, he says, "Truly I say to you, as you did not do to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me." It's the same message over and over throughout Scripture. God favors the weak. God favors the lowly, the despised, the things that are not. And that all seems just a little bit counterintuitive. It doesn't make a lot of sense to many people. One of the major themes throughout the world's religions is that God does honor the successful and the rich. That God prefers the powerful. That God is attracted to the beautiful. In Hinduism, people in those lower castes are looked down upon, and they are treated severely and roughly. They even have one caste that's called the Untouchables, because these are people that are so low that they are so unworthy to even be touched. In Hinduism, people are taught that those in those lower castes are that way because they've done more evil in their past lives than those in the upper classes. They're only getting what they deserve. Buddhism is the same story. When someone suffers, they suffer because they are receiving their karma. They are receiving their payment for their past sins. The idea that God would honor anything less than the best of humanity really runs counter to how most people think. Back in the 3rd century, there was a debate between a skeptic named Celsus and a Christian leader named Origen. And Celsus said to Origen, "When most teachers go forth to teach, they cry, 'Come to me, you who are clean and worthy.' And they are followed by the highest caliber of people available. But your silly master says, 'Come unto me, you who are down and beaten by life.' And then he so accumulates around him the rag, tag, and bobtail of humanity." Well, that makes sense to a lot of people, that God should only favor the best and brightest and most attractive. But then we read here in 1 Samuel 16, we find God favoring an unimpressive candidate for king. David is one of the least qualified by man's standards of the possible candidates for leadership in Israel. When Samuel comes to town and Jesse has the opportunity to parade his sons before this great prophet, Jesse didn't even bother in bringing David from the fields. David was insignificant. He was the runt of the litter. He wasn't worth a second thought when it came to impressing powerful men. Even Samuel, God's prophet, is taken by surprise. There in verse 6 of 1 Samuel 16 says that when they came in, he, being Samuel, looked at Eliab and thought, "Surely this is the Lord's anointed as before him." Well, Eliab was tall. He was handsome. He has the manner and the bearing of a great leader. He looks good on the outside. Then verse 7 tells us, "But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart.'" Don't be fooled what's on the outside. Don't be deceived by appearances. but a lot of people are. And it's an easy trap to get caught in on occasion. Joyce Brothers, of course, is a well-known popular psychologist. She wrote a book called Better Than Ever, and she points out that we often believe beautiful people have beautiful personalities. We consistently judge them to be more sensitive, kind, intelligent, interesting, sociable, and exciting than less attractive people. Then she goes on to speak of a study made in a school among kindergartners and teachers that attempt to determine what kinds of people that we are most attracted to. And Dr. Brothers observed this. She said that the children picked the most attractive children as their favorites. Their teachers did likewise and considered the less attractive children to be more likely to be troublemakers. I always wondered how I got pigeonholed in that troublemaker thing. But you know, that's kind of really how it goes. A lot of times, those people who are attractive and powerful and influential, that's how they do things in regular life. Sometimes that's how they attempt to do things in church as well. A lot of times it is those successful, beautiful, powerful people who become the troublemakers. Sometimes in a church setting, they want to be able to run roughshod and attempt to get their way because it works for them that way in the real world. It should also work for them among a body of believers as well. I know of a congregation who has a lot of prestigious members with positions of power. They were an in congregation to belong to, rich and powerful, because that's the kind of people that they had sitting in their pews. But just beneath that veneer really was a toleration for sin and a tendency to engage in power plays. And that's very much what the early church went through as well. They had a very similar problem. In James, the second chapter, beginning in verse 2, James teaches there that if a man wearing a gold ring and fine clothing comes into your assembly, and a poor man in shabby clothing also comes in, and if you pay more attention to the one who wears the fine clothing and say, "You sit here in a good place," while you say to the poor man, "You stand over there," or "Sit down at my feet," have you not then made distinction among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts? Listen, my beloved brothers, has not God chosen those who are poor in this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom, which he has promised to those who love him? But you have dishonored the poor man. Are not the rich the ones who oppress you and the ones who are dragging you into court? Well, why would the early church do that? Why would they favor the rich over the poor? Well, one of the reasons is they were fooled by appearances. They looked on the outside, and they failed to consider the heart of the person that they honored. Well, there are Christians who only want to invite the nice folks to church, and they don't ever think about inviting those that they don't think measure up. And that's an easy trap to fall into. But we need to make efforts to stop looking on the outward appearance and begin looking on the inside. And so this morning, the lesson for today is, of course, don't be deceived by appearances. Make that realization that God is not impressed by any degree. The rich and the famous don't excite God. When Susan Boyle took that stage on that British TV show, God already knew what she could do because God wasn't swayed by what was on the outside. He knew what lay within. And God is never deceived by appearances. The only thing that impresses God is the heart. Of course, one of my favorite verses in the Bible is 2 Chronicles 16:9, that first part of 2 Chronicles 16:9, where it tells us there that the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to give support to those whose heart is blameless toward him. And that's something that the world never quite understands. Whether it's on a talent show or within the many of this world's religions or even in our schoolrooms. Earlier we considered what Celsus said to Origen. When most teachers go forth, they cry, "Come to me, you who are clean and worthy." And they are followed by the highest caliber of people available. But your silly master says, "Come to me, you who are down and beaten by life." And so he accumulates around him the ragtag and bobtail of humanity. Now, Origen replied, yes, they are the ragtag and bobtail of humanity. But Jesus does not leave them that way. Of the material you would have thrown away as useless, he fashions men, giving them back their self-respect, enabling them to stand on their own two feet and to look God in the eyes. They were cowed and were cringing, broken things, but the Son has set them free. So this morning, the invitation is going to be yours in just a few moments. I do want to take just another few minutes, because I know you haven't heard enough about Vacation Bible School, to just hear a little bit more about it. I think that it is an opportunity for a lot of town kids that may not ever walk into a church building, but their mom and dad will send them to Vacation Bible School for a few hours just to get them out of the house. That getting them out of the house is our opportunity to try to teach them just a little bit, and again, quite possibly about stories that they have never heard before. And so it's a real chance to provide a real impact to some kids who really need a good impact to happen for them. This morning, of course, the lesson is yours. If you're not a Christian and you need to make that decision, now would be an opportune time. If you are a Christian and need the prayers of this congregation, again, now would be a time for you to make that known, as together we stand and we sing.